Hi, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2018, and you're listening to episode 58 of Postmodern Realities. And I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by our resident film reviewer, Dr. John McAteer. John is an assistant professor and chair of the Online Liberal Arts program at Ashford University. He has a BA in film from Biola University, a MA in philosophy of religion and ethics from Talbot School of Theology, and a PhD in philosophy from the University of California at Riverside. John has written a film review about the 2018 Oscar-nominated film, The Shape of Water, and his review is called How the Shape of Water's Fishman Symbolizes Christian Grace, which is available free online at our website, equip.org. John, it's good to have you on.
It's good to be here.
Well, this particular film is getting a lot of buzz. I think for this year, it was the most Oscar-nominated film in the running, and including for Best Director for Guillermo del Toro, who also wrote the screenplay. And so I would like you to explain a little bit to our listeners what it's about. It's a little bit of magical realism. It's very different.
Yeah, it is kind of a strange movie. I think it's helpful to keep in mind that it's supposed to be like a fairy tale. Although in some ways it's also almost like a horror movie. Maybe we'll talk about it later. But it's you could think of it as a remake of the classic Hollywood movie, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, but from a different point of view. So I don't know if your listeners have seen that original film, but in The Creature from the Black Lagoon, you have these scientists who go into the Amazon and the jungle, and they find this creature there who's sort of like basically a fish, but, you know, looks like a person using two arms and two legs and that kind of thing. And he's worshipped as a god there. He has some kind, you know, extra powers. And they, capture him and bring him back to America to study scientifically, maybe use him as a weapon against the Russians and that kind of thing. But in the original movie, he escapes and kidnaps a woman, like, you know, all these old monster movies. They always escape and kidnap a woman, and then, you know, the heroes have to go rescue her. You think about, not just The Creature from the Black Lagoon, but, King Kong and even Frankenstein and these kinds of stories. It's one of those stories. But in The Shape of Water, they take that basic plot from The Creature of the Black Lagoon and tell it from the woman's point of view. In this case, she's a janitor who works at the military base or the laboratory where the creature is being held captive. And she basically, falls in love with the monster and helps him escape. So in this time, she's not kidnapped, but she's rescuing the monster. Sort of the villain isn't the monster, but is the scientists or the military people captured him. So it's got a lot of kind of role reversals there. The movie, like I say, is obviously fantastical. This creature also has a lot of references to classic films, as we already said, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, but also fairy tales. I see a lot of Beauty and the Beast there, this romance between the woman and this creature, maybe a little bit of The Little Mermaid and other stories like that. So it's really just kind of a blend of lots of different influences in this kind of postmodern way that I thought was a lot of fun.
Well, the subtitle of the screenplay is A Fable for Our Troubled Times. And I think I heard in an interview with Guillermo del Toro that he was saying that's what he originally had hoped that the actual film would be named, but they went with a different title. But how is this movie a fable?
So when I think of a fable, I don't know entirely what, you know, Guillermo del Toro meant by that, but I think of like, you know, a parable or a story with a lesson. And this does seem to have a pretty clear message or lesson that the filmmakers have in mind. It's kind of a progressive fairy tale. It's meant to kind of question some of our society's assumptions around you know, race and gender and just, you know, politics in general. If you think about a lot of all the heroes of the story, all the main characters that we would consider the good guys in this story, they all are sort of marginalized people, you know, outsiders who don't fit into the system. For example, you know, the main character, the woman who's the well, she's a janitor, so she's already sort of, you know, lower working class, but she's also disabled. So she's mute. She had her vocal cords cut as a child, so she can't speak. So in a way, she's, you know, literally has no voice. So she's a kind of a symbol of the voiceless, the powerless people in society. But so are the other characters. You know, they're all women. Her best friend is an African-American. There's a gay man who plays her neighbor. So there's all these different kinds of sort of progressive icons who are in this coalition fighting against basically this, you know, straight white man who's kind of the typical macho military type. Colonel Strickland is his name. So you can see from his name another kind of symbolic element. He's very strict and very rigid and legalistic. So I think the parable element or the fable element seems to be you know, pretty clear.
Well, actually, in your review, you wrote this, quote, Del Toro paints a picture of a divided America in which straight white Christian men are considered the norm and all deviants who fail to conform to the mainstream standard are marginalized. It is the kind of America many conservatives look back on with nostalgia, end quote. A couple of things. First of all, are you saying that conservatism is inherently racist and that politically conservative people want to marginalize minorities? And then also, how does it painting Christianity, because in sections of the film, which I did see, he's quoting the Bible to some of these other, quote, marginalized characters?
Right. Yeah. Thanks for asking that, because I think that section maybe wasn't written as clearly as I intended. So when I talk about sort of this vision of old-fashioned America where, you know, the mainstream, you know, there's this mainstream standard that we're meant to conform to. And if you don't conform to it, you're considered a deviant. Basically, what I have in mind, you know, this is maybe a hot button word these days, but you've heard of the idea of white supremacy, which used to mean, you know, guys that put on white sheets who go to your house in the night and, you know, take minorities out and lynch them and that kind of thing. Or even the people we saw marching with the torches in Charlottesville, you know, but that's not really what most kind of race theory people mean these days when they talk about white supremacy. They just mean a worldview according to which white people are normal and anybody who's not white is considered abnormal. And this is a subconscious kind of thing. It's not that you're thinking to yourself, if you're a white supremacist, that I hate everybody who's not white and I want to, you know, keep them out of power, you know, intentionally and this kind of thing. It's more an attitude that anybody can have regardless of your race. And part of the kind of tragedy of race relations in America now is how minorities have in various ways taken on the same attitude. So to give an example of what we mean by white supremacy, you know, it's just the idea when this is an example I think about sometimes when color film was invented by Kodak back, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, they designed the chemicals and the formulas and things to reproduce skin tones of white people, because in their mind, that's what the people who bought film were, because the people who were making the film and designing all this themselves were white. So they didn't even think about it. It wasn't like racism, because they weren't like, we're going to design this film so that it makes white people look normal and black people don't show up in the color film in a normal way. It was just an assumption that they had, unconscious assumption that normal people who use film are white. And so when they made the film, film stocks, and they sold it, it wasn't able to reproduce dark skin tones in the normal way. And you can say the same kind of things with skin tones in makeup, you know, the assumption that, you know, people who buy makeup are going to have certain skin tones. So again, this is not traditional white supremacy, but this is what people mean by it. So when I talk about defining what's normal as white, that's what I have in mind. So this, the way when this gets kind of controversial then is when people look back at early periods in America and say, you know, wasn't that a great time when, you know, in the 1950s, say, when everything was designed in this certain way. And you know, people who say this aren't thinking to themselves, I want to go back to when black people were oppressed. If you ask them, they would say, no, I believe in civil rights. You know, I want everything, you know, people to be equal. But a lot of the social structures they have in mind are arguably oppressive, right? So if you think about, you know, we want to go back to a time when gender roles were a certain way, and there was the father knows best, and the wife was quiet and never questioned the father in the family, and that kind of thing. Again, there are, you know, strengths and weaknesses of different ways of arranging families, but just the assumption that a normal family is going to be one with you know, a man and a woman married together, and the woman is going to do exactly whatever the man decides without question, right? That's what I mean by this kind of nostalgia for a different way than things are now. And I'm not even saying that the way things used to be is bad in all cases. In many cases, we have gotten off track in society. So I'm not, I don't want this to be read as conservatism is racist necessarily. It's just a complicated, a mixed bag of different kinds of things that get lumped together into this vision.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is John McAteer. John has written a film review about the 2018 Oscar-nominated film, The Shape of Water, and his review is called How the Shape of Water's Fishman Symbolizes Christian Grace, which is available free online at our website, equip.org. To read more cultural apologetics articles, including our upcoming cover story on the Hulu TV series The Handmaid's Tale, Disney Princesses, and an article on the worldview of actor Morgan Freeman, please subscribe to the journal. Until February 10th, 2018, we have a special subscription rate of $25, and normally a six-issue subscription is $39.50. To subscribe online, go to equip.org. Well, I'd still like you to address some of the ways in which the film portrays Christianity. On one hand, in your review, you're suggesting that the film symbolizes Christian grace. And so are you thinking this is a Christian film? And yet, on the other hand, it seemed to paint Christianity in somewhat of a negative light when one of the main characters, who is looked upon as a bad character, is quoting scripture to one of the other cleaning ladies.
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the scenes where the scripture is quoted is the most important one, I think, is this discussion of what it means to be in the Lord's image. So this is a good example of what I was talking about earlier. So this Colonel Strickland character says something like, this is an exact quote, but he says something like, you know, we all know that man was made in the Lord's image, but this creature is not not like us, so he can't be in the Lord's image, right? That, he says something like, that's not what the Lord looks like. So we could take this as a kind of critique of Christianity, except that it so obviously mischaracterizes what Christians believe. You know, Christians don't think being made in the Lord's image means that God looks like us. For one thing, that gets the image backwards, right? It's not that God is in our image and that God looks like a human being, but rather that human beings are in God's image. And, you know, what that means exactly, you know, the various theories to that, but certainly it has nothing to do with what people look like. And so I think this is supposed to show, you know, certainly a kind of prejudice on the behalf of the Colonel Strickland character, but also some of his confusion there. And just to be fair, it does reflect perhaps a mistake that some of us fall into as Christians sometimes. We do tend to make the Bible say what we want it to say, which I think is what Colonel Strickland's doing there. You know, this is a temptation we all have to constantly be on guard for, trying to hear what God is really saying to us through Scripture versus hearing ourselves speaking and using the Bible to justify our own ideas. So I think it's a fair critique in a way, because we do that all the time as Christians, especially if we ever were to say something like, you know, human beings are made in God's image, therefore, you know, God must be a male, for example, as opposed to being beyond gender. If we say God is actually a male, and so that means that anybody who's not a male is less than fully in the image of God, right? Or if you say, well, God is in our image and I'm white, so God must be white, and anybody who's not white is therefore not fully in the image of God, right? And these are things that no you know, Orthodox Christian would actually believe, but if we're fair, people have said things like this throughout history, abusing Christianity, I would say. And then you ask about, what was your other question about how the film symbolizes grace?
Yes, just about the title of the article itself, your review, that this film symbolizes Christian grace. So on one hand, you know, there's this situation with the image of God and the quoting of Scripture and the misapplication of that, but in what other ways is it showing Christianity in a positive light? And because there is an element that you say that is Christian grace in this film, would you consider this a Christian film?
I see. No, not really. I don't think the film is, I wouldn't call it a Christian film, at least not intentionally. Guillermo del Toro, the writer and director, was raised Catholic in Mexico. It comes from a kind of Christian family, a Christian culture. But as far as I know, he doesn't consider himself a Christian anymore. You know, he's kind of moved away from that in his personal life. But clearly his kind of imagination has been shaped by this Christian culture. And so he thinks in those terms. And I do think he intentionally uses Christian imagery throughout the film. And I do think, as far as, you know, the film as a symbol of grace, I do think he gets a lot of the gospel right. So, for example, just Christian imagery in the film, the fish man himself, the main kind of monster, is portrayed as a Christ figure in a way that I find hard to miss. It just seems fairly obvious and intentional. So when I say he's a Christ figure, this is a common trope among literature and film, even by non-Christians, portraying a person, especially whenever a person, you know, dies and rises again in a film, or even if it's just symbolically dying. This is something that happens a lot in movies. You know, at the final scene of a movie, the hero will seem to die and then be rescued. You know, I think again of Beauty and the Beast, right? So the monster in Beauty and the Beast seems to have died at the end, but then the, you know, Beauty, I don't know, it's just she kisses him. Usually the woman kisses him and they come back to life. So that's a kind of Christian Christ figure symbolism. But in this film, it goes further in that the hero being half man, half fish, he kind of symbolizes Christ's dual nature, you know, being God and man. The creature also symbolizes the incarnation in that he comes from sort of another world. He's not one of us, but he comes in as an outsider into our world, the human world. So that's kind of incarnational. Just that he's a fish in general symbolizes Christianity, and that the fish has been used as a symbol of Christianity, like the ichthus symbol that we sometimes put on our car, you know. The creature also performs miracles. He is misunderstood and persecuted unjustly by society. He just seems to follow this pattern of very basic outlines of Jesus. And then in terms of grace, I think the film is very interested in the idea of legalism and the law versus grace kind of dichotomy. And this, again, seen in the character of Colonel Strickland. So if we want to think of Colonel Strickland as a character quoting the Bible, I would say he's much closer to a Pharisee than he is to a Christian. He's more like the characters in the Bible who rejected Jesus because Jesus didn't fit into their conception of what God's law was about and what God was going to do in the world and what the Messiah would be, right? So Colonel Strickland is shown as very concerned with external appearances in the film. He's buys a new car because it's said to be the car of the future. You know, he's very concerned with kind of just a stereotypical, white picket fence house in the suburbs, having the perfect family, all of that kind of stuff. But also he's always said to be, strict adherence to regulations and rules. It's just, again, he's a symbol of legalism and drawing lines to show who is, following the rules and who's not. But in the film, I think kind of undercuts him and shows that his way is actually oppressive, and that the true, what's beautiful about the fish man is that he's able to accept people who are different for themselves, and not because they fit into some predetermined mold of what people ought to be like before they're able to be loved. Right. So the woman who falls in love with him says, when he looks at me, he doesn't see the ways that I'm lacking or whatever, something like that. So meaning because they are able to communicate without speech, because neither of them can talk, that her disability doesn't prevent her from having a relationship with him. Just like we as fallen, sinful people fail to measure up to perfection in many ways, but that doesn't prevent God from loving us and reaching out towards us and being in relationship with us. So I think that message seems very, intentional and quite on track for Christianity.
Is there any other character or any other part of the film that you think gives a direct message of grace in addition to the actual fishman?
Maybe. I don't know. Do you have something in mind?
Well, I kind of feel like the main character is her name, Eliza.
Yeah.
And I feel like she does, because he is being tortured by the scientist, main character, and she is willing to bridge communication with him. So she reaches out to him a little bit. And so I feel like she is showing him grace, and that she risks also her job and maybe even her life to help him out of his captivity.
Sure. I see that for sure. And Eliza's friends, her neighbor and her coworker also are the same way, right? It's kind of amazing to think of this thing that would basically be a monster in a different movie, but all of these people risk their lives to save it. So yeah, there's Christ-likeness going all around here, I think.
So there is some sexuality and language and some more mature themes, a lot of violence. Would you recommend Christians to see this film?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, certainly not all Christians. Well, everyone will have to be, warned of the content and aware of their own sensitivities and maturity. I think it's important to remember, as I mentioned at the very beginning, that Guillermo del Toro is essentially a horror filmmaker. If you look at his other films that he made before this, most of them are horror films. And so he brings a lot of that sensibility to the film. There's a lot of sex and nudity right from the very beginning of the film. You know, if you watch the first 10 minutes of the movie, you should know, if it's for you. But there's sexuality, and then also just kind of disgusting blood and guts kind of stuff that comes from a horror background that can be hard to watch for some people. I personally found the movie beautiful, and it really cast a spell on me, put me in this kind of mood, like a lot of classic Hollywood movies. But I could see how the nudity and violence could make it hard to watch for many Christian viewers, so they should be warned about that.
Yes, it's also rated R, so I thought the listener should know that it's a rated R film. But it is very, the production of it is very beautiful, and it's quite an artistic film.
I agree.
Well, thanks, John, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast. And finally, I want to end with some rapid-fire questions for you. So it's almost Super Bowl. That's this weekend. So buffalo wings or nachos?
Nachos, I think.
Fiction or nonfiction?
In general, I enjoy fiction more, but for some reason, I mostly read nonfiction. Maybe it's my job.
And which 2018 film are you looking most forward to watching?
I'm looking forward to The Wrinkle in Time. So we'll see how Hollywood does with that one and see if they can maintain the Christianity that's in the novel that I love so much.
And who's one of your favorite directors?
I think I really love Kubrick is one of my kind of classic directors. I love all of his films and go back to them again and again.
Well, thanks again for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you.
John has written a film review about the 2018 Oscar-nominated film, The Shape of Water, and his review is called How the Shape of Water's Fishman Symbolizes Christian Grace. It's available free online at our website, equip.org. To read more cultural apologetic articles in our journal, including the upcoming cover feature article on the Hulu television series, The Handmaid's Tale, and an article on Disney princesses, and an upcoming article on the worldview of actor Morgan Freeman, please subscribe to the journal. For the month of February, until February 10th, 2018, we have a special subscription rate of $25, and normally a 6-issue subscription is $39.50. To subscribe online, visit equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes and rate and review our podcast. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Hank is also streaming live each week on Facebook and YouTube, so check equip.org for dates and times. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's new audio podcast. Follow Hank Off the Grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.